I also want to say that with regard to educational institutions, whether it's higher education or whether it's K through 12, that there is a law called the Title VI from the U.S. Department of Education. Title VI says that any educational institution receiving federal funding, and that is just about all public schools right up to the university, receive some type of federal funding. And if there's any discrimination going on the campuses of these institutions of education, the Title VI funding, the federal funding, will be suspended. So the U.S. government is saying to the administrations on our campuses, you all receive our federal funding. If you don't crack down on pro-Palestinian solidarity, on this protest against the genocide, we're going to suspend your funding. So this is extremely, extremely serious. And again, which is a short interview, so I'm only scratching the surface. There's so much more going on.
Professor Robinson, we've talked about one facet of the plan called the Consciousness Axis. What are some of the other facets or ways in which Israel has carried out its hope for overall purpose of the plan to basically shut down all or as much of organized anti-Israeli protest and speech as possible?
Yes. So as I mentioned previously, there are four axes. That's how they're described. The first one was the consciousness axis that we discussed. The second, they titled the legal axis. And I will quote directly, the plan calls for taking legal action outside the law. Now, I have to say, I don't know what they mean by outside the law. It's not specified in the plan. But taking legal action outside the law against activities and organizations that pose a threat to Jewish and Israeli students on campuses such as Students for Justice in Palestine. And then the plan adds that Israel will hold discussions with elements of the U.S. Department of Justice to map out legal tools that can be used. That is the second axis, and this is already well underway as we've been discussing. The third axis then they call the economic axis. And again, to quote it, it says Israel will identify leading donors within the Jewish and Israeli communities and enlist them in the struggle to serve as a lever of pressure on university heads to act against anti-Semitism. It continues, quote, Israel will exert pressure on Jewish and non-Jewish donors to withdraw their investments from campuses where anti-Semitism is not addressed and promote economic sanctions against universities receiving federal or state public funding for non-addressing anti-Semitism on campuses. So this is extremely important because we need to remember in the case, for instance, of my university, that's the University of California, but in public universities and also the private universities. We used to, at the public universities, get significant public funding, but that's changed through neoliberalism in the last 20 years. The funding now, for instance, at the University of California comes, first of all, from tuition, which has skyrocketed. Thousands and thousands of dollars the tuition has increased. But secondly, the big funding comes from private, individual, and corporate donors. And these individual and corporate donors include Zionists, wealthy millionaire Zionists, and also the corporations that are making unbelievable amounts of profits in Israel and in their activity with Israel. So the plan says these donors need to pressure the administrations. The administrations will find that the donations won't come, and therefore there will be a budgetary crisis. So that's already well underway. That's not new, but again, we're seeing an escalation in this case. I want to remind you that one billionaire, Jewish American donor to Harvard, cut back on hundreds of millions of dollars for Harvard's endowment. Very publicly, he did so. And that was a message to all university administrators saying, look, we'll do this to you too. So the fourth and final axis in this plan, Israeli government plan, task force plan, they call the explanatory axis. And it involves, and I'm quoting, creating a toolbox available to pro-Israeli professors and students, assisting them in addressing claims against the pro-Israeli side physically and especially on social networks. The foreign ministry will explore the option of launching a campaign on social networks focused on campuses. Their goal here is to mobilize Zionist forces on campuses to join with this more broader campaign of repression against any Palestine sentiment on campuses. And this dimension is not new. Again, this has been going on for many years. So, you know, any Jewish American can get free of charge, is invited by the Israeli government to go to Israel, where they're indoctrinated into Zionist ideology, and then come back to the United States and act as an agent of Zionism. That is starting to crack. I hope later in an interview we're going to discuss how young Jewish Americans are breaking with Zionism. They're leading. They're one of the key components leading this massive upsurge in solidarity with Palestine. But nonetheless, there are all of these organizations of the Israel lobby that are operating on U.S. university campuses. There's six or seven of them, and they go after any Palestine solidarity activity on campuses, and they do so in collaboration with administrators and with the groups off campus. That's what happened on my campus, the University of California at Santa Barbara. The point of this final axis is, how do you cultivate a mass active base of support among Jewish Americans? And that's been very successful historically. Again, now it's starting to crack, but this is part of the task force goal to beef that up. And I want to point out one other thing, is that why is it that there is such a significant base of support for Zionism and the Israeli state among Jewish Americans? Well, that's an historical story, which I know we don't have time to go into, but I simply want to say that the Israeli strategy, the Zionist strategy, has been an extreme form of trauma manipulation, to take the trauma and the suffering and the grief of the Holocaust and to use that and manipulate that to tell Jewish Americans or Jews all around the world that they face an existential threat, and the only way to avoid that existential threat is blind defense of Israel and of Zionism. That's worked for many decades, and now that strategy is eroding.
Yes, Professor Robinson, thank you. Thank you for that last answer. And it's interesting because the recent Gallup poll showed that now 55% of the American adults are actually condemned what Israel is doing in Gaza. I think we can credit, sadly, the actions of Israel itself, but also of this powerful movement that you've talked about. It has had some gains, has it not?
Absolutely. The gains have been unbelievable. We've never seen such an upsurge in solidarity with, you know, with Palestine. So here in the United States, I'm in Southern California, and we've had on campus, but also off campuses, we've had these mass mobilizations. And the two organizations that have been really leading these mass mobilizations are, one, Jewish Voices for Peace, which, as I understand, is the largest anti-Zionist Jewish organization in the world. And people of all ages, but largely young Jewish Americans, are joining Jewish Voices for Peace and taking part in these protests and putting forward an alternative narrative that Judaism is a religion of universal values, and this has nothing to do with Zionism. By the way, the other big organization here is Palestine Youth Movement. So here's young Jews and young Palestinians are coming together to lead this movement in Southern California. And I want to reiterate something that I mentioned at the beginning of the interview, and it is this unprecedented upsurge in solidarity with Palestine and consciousness among young Jews and young people in general, which has led the Israeli government to escalate its repression in collaboration, in close support and collaboration with the U.S. government to escalate this crackdown. And by the way, I don't want to end the interview without pointing out what listeners will already know, that this is not just an Israeli genocide. It's really an Israeli-U.S.-NATO genocide.
We are sadly just about out of time. What are your last brief thoughts on this critically important topic? And also, where can our listeners find your writings, your books, and so forth?
Sure. Well, I want to say one thing about the direction of Palestine solidarity in the immediate short term, so as to bring about a ceasefire, which is the most urgent issue, but also in the medium term. And the one key ingredient which is missing here is labor, right? Is the working classes, not having to do with the universities. And I think, in large part, this is a long history, the story of the collaborationist union leadership holding back the rank and file. We've had a number of important union victories in terms of the UAW, the postal workers, and others calling for a ceasefire. But if labor were to come on board in a big way, such as the stevedores, you know, the port workers not shipping weapons from U.S. ports to Israel and so forth, that would be of critical importance to stop this genocide. So that's a big task. But I want to conclude by saying that I think right now the genocide has shocked the world. It's touched a deep chord among all of humanity. And I think all around the world, people are protesting because we're in solidarity with Palestine and because we have the absolute revulsion of seeing real life genocide, but also because all around the world, we're in a deep crisis. We're in a crisis of unprecedented inequalities, of rising mass deprivation, of precarious work. Young people in the United States don't have much of a future, very uncertain future. And I think right now, the world's people see Palestine solidarity as the front line of defense of all of us at a time of this severe crisis. We see our humanity in Palestine.